Hello, and welcome to this Boehringer Ingelheim sponsored promotional podcast entitled Effective Management of Type 2 Diabetes in Adults, the Role of Individualised Patient Care. My name's Sarah Jarvis, I'm a GP and Clinical Director of Patient.info, and I'm delighted to be joined by Paul Dromgoole, Clinical Lecturer in Diabetes and Diabetes Specialist Nurse from Lincolnshire. This promotional podcast is an abbreviated version of the webinar broadcast on the 13th of July 2021. To view the full video version with the slides, please click on the button beneath the podcast player. Prescribing information for Tradjenta, linagliptin and adverse event reporting information can be found on the website hosting this podcast. Just as a reminder though, Tradjenta is indicated for adults with type 2 diabetes as an adjunct, obviously, to diet and exercise to improve glycemic control. It's monotherapy where metformin is inappropriate due to intolerance or contraindicated due to renal impairment, or it's licensed in combination with other medicinal products for the treatment of diabetes, including insulin, where these do not provide adequate glycemic control. Well, type 2 diabetes is a problem. We have a burgeoning incidence of type 2 diabetes. Just earlier this year, we discovered from the Diabetes UK figures that we now have 4.1 million people diagnosed with diabetes, of whom over 90% have type 2 diabetes, and we have probably another 850,000 people who are undiagnosed but who are living with type 2 diabetes. Now that means that we have virtually doubled the cases in 20 years. We know that there are lots of factors that increase your risk of type 2 diabetes. We know that age does increase your risk, as does family history, as does ethnicity. For instance, people of Afro-Caribbean, Black African or South Asian descent are 2 to 4 times more likely to develop type 2 diabetes. But the elephant in the room is obesity. We've seen that the incidence of obesity has doubled in 20 years, from 6.9 million to 13 million people today. And that's in England alone. And we also know that according to Diabetes UK, between 80 and 85% of your risk of developing type 2 diabetes relates to your weight. So the other factors are important, but the predominant one is weight. And type 2 diabetes costs a lot. We probably spend in the NHS £8.8 billion per year, and prescribing costs alone account for about £1 billion. But of course, importantly, the prescribing costs are dwarfed by the costs of complications. The vast majority of the direct costs of diabetes to the NHS arise from the cost of complications. And the most expensive of those complications, both in financial and in human terms, are cardiovascular complications, kidney-related complications, and excess inpatient days. So what are we going to do about it? Well, we need to think about why those complications happen. The complications include atherosclerosis, kidney failure, blindness, diabetic retinopathy, and of course, lower limb amputation as a result of diabetic neuropathy. A 2 to 3-fold higher incidence of heart failure, the rapidest growing macrovascular, indeed the rapidest growing complication of type 2 diabetes. 15% of adults with diabetes have heart failure. 44% of new people diagnosed with kidney failure are seen in people with diabetes. And about 1 in 6 people over 65 dies from a stroke. 30% of people with diabetes over 40 years have diabetic retinopathy. That could be a lot worse if it wasn't for our amazing diabetic retinopathy screening service. And 60%, this is an extraordinary figure, 60% of non-traumatic lower limb amputations occur as a complication of diabetes. But the excess mortality is largely down to cardiovascular disease. Yes, we have made great inroads in our mortality figures for cardiovascular disease, but even so, about 1/3 of people with type 2 diabetes have cardiovascular disease, and it accounts for about half of all deaths. It can occur 10 to 15 years earlier in someone with diabetes than somebody who doesn't. And it's, if anything, more of a problem for women than it is for men. Now, the UK PDS study is possibly, even now, the most influential study on type 2 diabetes ever done, and it is a very old study now. But we do have other studies, of course. We have ACCORD, we have ADVANCE, we have VADT. All of them show that tight glycemic control significantly improves microvascular outcomes, by which we mean, of course, kidney outcomes, eyes, and nerve outcomes, including amputation. But, and here's the big but, when UKPDS first came out, we assumed that there might be a bit of a benefit from in terms of cardiovascular disease, in terms of myocardial infarction, macrovascular complications, but at the time of UKPDS, it did not reach statistical significance. However, what we saw in UKPDS in the follow-up was that by 10 years after people have left the study, and sadly those in the tight glycemic control arm saw their HbA1cs rise to almost exactly the same level as those in the standard glycemic control arm within a couple of years, what we saw was that 10 years later, those benefits in terms of macrovascular as well as microvascular outcomes were sustained in terms of percentage terms, and that meant that reduction had become statistically significant because these patients were now older and they'd had longer to develop cardiovascular disease. And what that tells us is that tight glycemic control in the early stages of diabetes, in particular, the first 10 to 20 years that you have diabetes, reduces not just the risk of microvascular complications, but the risk of macrovascular. And it doesn't just reduce them at the time, it reduces them for life. The so-called legacy effect. And yet, despite this, therapeutic inertia persists. The glycemic burden is therefore raised. We collude, if anything, with our patients. They don't want us to intensify treatment. They're really happy when we don't intensify treatment. And of course, as a result, we think we're doing the right thing. We say, oh, we'll give you another 3 months. We'll give you another 3 months. And the next thing we know, they've been living with this glycemic burden for years. So how do we personalise glucose-lowering treatment? What factors do we need to consider? Personal preference, of course, is really important. Age, disease duration, body weight, comorbidities, clinical experience of the medications, safety, efficacy, cost, all those things come into the equation. And it's a complicated old equation once you add all of those. But of course, the really important thing is that in older people in particular, the risks of very tight glycemic control may well outweigh the benefit, depending on the level of glycemic control and depending on the drug that you use. And that means that we need to adjust glycemic targets in many older patients, particularly where frailty is involved. Now, the NICE guidance on type 2 diabetes is, of course, now, frankly, really very out of date, but we have got other guidances around. The ADA and the EASD guidance have produced much, much more detailed, more recent guidance in terms of what we should be doing. But one thing the NICE guidance does say is to talk about individualized care, tailoring it to the needs and circumstances of the individual patient, thinking about multi-morbidity and reassessing the patient at every review and wondering whether you need to stop treatment, as well, of course, as taking into account disabilities. But what about our older patients? For those, we need to balance glycemic control against the risk. We need to preserve autonomy as much as we can. And really importantly, we have to think about quality of life. ADA guidance for healthy older people recommend an HbA1c less than 58 millimoles per mole. That's less than 7.5%. For patients with complex needs or intermediate risk, and maybe have an intermediate life expectancy, they're looking more in the region of 8 to 8.5%, that's 64 to 69 millimoles per mole. And for very complex patients, we need to adjust the target even further because, of course, the main aim of tight glycemic control is to reduce long-term complications. Some patients may be symptomatic, and that is important, but for very frail patients with a short life expectancy, we do need to adjust those targets. David Strain and his colleagues have guidance for frailty and older patients, and they come up with very similar results, but they're much more specific about what they say we should be doing. For instance, for the healthy, pre-frail, mildly frail patient, we should be looking to see if we can reverse frailty, because it can happen. We should be looking at tight glycemic control because they have a longer life expectancy and they have more to gain and less to lose, of course, from tight glycemic control. So we should be looking at less than 58 millimoles per mole and a fasting blood glucose between 5 and 7.2, as well as blood pressure less than 140 over 90. For moderate frailty, they go up 8% and likewise a blood pressure of 140 over 90. But for the very severely frail patients with significant comorbidities, with functional deficits and with markedly reduced life expectancy, we're looking there at HbA1c less than 8.5%, that's 69 millimoles per mole and a blood pressure of 150 over 90. Now these days, I was speaking at the ESD just at the end of last year, and somebody, one of my colleagues, one of my co-speakers, referred to the DPP-4s as our old familiar friends. In terms of second-line treatment, the sulfonylureas quite appropriately are dropping over time, and the DPP-4s are increasing over time. Guidelines do recommend DPP-4s at various stages as an option, whether it's the NICE guidance, which, as I say, comes from 2015, perhaps they are an old familiar friend, whether it's the SINE guidance, which recommends them as a second and third line option, or whether it's the ADA-EASD report that I referred to earlier, which says that they are a second line option where there's a need to minimise hypoglycemia, or a third line option in most other patients. So what about those cardiovascular outcomes that I referred to? It is important to remember that the DPP-4s were all introduced after the rosy glitter zone debacle, when, of course, we saw an increase in the incidence of cardiovascular disease, looking at a summary review, and a trend towards an increase in cardiovascular death, which did not reach statistical significance. As a result, the FDA mandated cardiovascular outcome trials. So we started with TCOS, sitagliptin versus placebo, Savatimi, saxagliptin versus placebo, Carolina, Tragenta versus glimepiride, and Carmelina, which was Tragenta versus placebo. Tragenta has two cardiovascular outcome trials, one against a sulfonylurea and one versus placebo. Renal safety, yes, and it is the only one of these which has renal safety confirmed by a pre-specified secondary outcome and no increased risk of hospitalization for heart failure. Tragenta, importantly, does not require dose adjustment at any stage of hepatic impairment or at renal impairment. Is that important? Yes, it's very important, because what we see is that consistently, regardless of renal function, you get a consistent reduction in HbA1c from Tragenta. Whether it's normal, mild, moderate, or severe impairment, you are seeing effectively the same 0.7%, that's 7 to 7.5 millimoles per mole reduction in HbA1c. We also know that the efficacy is established across many different age groups, including patients over the age of 75. And again, a reduction of 0.77%, so about 8 millimoles per mole among patients over the age of 75. We also saw in both Carmelina and Carolina, those two studies, the Tragenta subgroup analysis for patients aged over 75. And what we saw was that in Carmelina, we had over 1,600 patients who were over 75. In Carolina, almost 1,000 patients, 846, who were over 75. So 55% of the patients in Carmelina, 65 or over. Basically 50% of patients in Carolina, 65 or older. In Carmelina, the tests for superiority for the primary outcome, 3-point MACE, and the key secondary outcome, the composite of kidney outcomes, in the overall population were not met. As a result, all other analyses and outcomes, including the risk of hospitalisation for heart failure, are considered exploratory. In terms of the 3-point MACE, what we saw in Carmelina was p-value of 0.0. 0.001 for non-inferiority. No sign of an increase in three-point MACE. In terms of the secondary key outcome, kidney outcomes, likewise, we saw no significant increase in kidney outcomes. And in terms of hospitalization for heart failure among that older population, no significant interaction between age and treatment effect in terms of heart failure. So very reassuring figures across the board there. In Carolina, again, as a note, as the test for superiority of the primary outcome, three-point MACE, in the overall population was not significant, all subsequent analyses and outcomes, including the incidence of hypoglycemia, hospitalization for heart failure, and achieving HbA1c target without weight gain and without the need for rescue medication, are considered exploratory. Importantly, there was a lower risk of moderate or severe hypoglycemia with Tradjenta compared to glimepiride. Not entirely surprising. We also saw, importantly, more patients over the age of 75 achieving HbA1c targets, regardless of whether those targets, and we've just seen Strain et al. Recommend that we adjust our targets according to frailty, but we saw more patients in this study achieving target HbA1c without hypoglycemia, without 2% weight gain or more, and without needing rescue medication. In summary, the goals for effective treatment include optimization, but targeted optimization of treatment. There are challenges in providing individualized care, especially when we consider patients' age, frailty, and comorbidities. But Tradjenta 5 milligrams has efficacy and safety demonstrated in a broad range of patient cohorts with type 2 diabetes. So the dose of linagliptin is always 5 milligrams. It doesn't depend on your liver function, your renal function, your age, your disease duration, or your body mass index. And it now gives me great pleasure to hand over to my colleague Paul Dromgoole to talk about shared decision making in type 2 diabetes.
Welcome, everybody. So I'm going to talk us through shared decision-making in type 2 diabetes. Brief presentation, but hopefully there'll be bits and pieces that you could pick out of this presentation. I think as health professionals, we've really got to understand that actually, although we look at type 2 diabetes as a very risky condition, this cardiorenometabolic condition, it's not always the picture that the patient sees of their diabetes. How many of your patients believe diabetes is a touch of sugar? How many of them believe this is a mild condition? I've got mild diabetes. Now, as health professionals, all of us will say, well, mild diabetes absolutely doesn't exist, but many of our patients may come to their diagnosis with that understanding. And I'm going to explore one or two issues around that as we go through. So I've just picked 3 points out of a paper by Toulon. In fact, it's entitled No Worries, No Impact, A Systematic Review. This review, the systematic review, confirms that the diagnosis of type 2 diabetes has limited long-term emotional impact, if at all, regardless of how patients are detected. So just moving on, the same paper, examination of cognitive and behavioural responses indicate that most patients underestimate the seriousness of their type 2 diabetes, overestimate their ability to control it, and show limited engagement in the management of their disease or condition. So this isn't all, but the paper suggests the majority. And the final bullet point, the conclusions so far, may instead reflect patients' tendencies to avoid dealing with and managing their type 2 diabetes until the first signs and symptoms appear, potentially undermining the effectiveness of early detection and treatment. And Sarah took us through this thing around clinical inertia, therapeutic inertia, and I think again it's so important that, you know, we give these messages early so we don't in a way undermine that effective early detection of diabetes. So what I want to do is just quickly run through a health belief model by Stretcher and Rosenstock. And I think this is really important in terms of trying to get an understanding as to what causes people to become engaged with their condition. So Strecher and Rosenstock looked at a number of concepts or constructs. First was perceived susceptibility. How susceptible do people feel that they are in relation to the condition or complications of that condition? Next, perceived severity. How severe are those things? Perceived benefits of doing anything about this, and perceived barriers. Importantly, cues to action, which in type 2 diabetes it may well not be symptoms of the condition, but it could be prompts by the health professional, prompts by the family, or even reminders like a fridge magnet or whatever. So cues to action. And that was the health belief model until another construct got added, and this is self-efficacy, the belief that if we wanted to do it, could we do it? And I'll just have you think briefly about this. How many of our patients do believe ideally they would lose weight, become more active, etc., but many of our patients don't believe they can do it? So, health belief model, but I want to just look at this a slightly different way. And in a way, what I want to do is to go back up the health belief model to the first construct around perceived susceptibility. And if the patient doesn't believe they're susceptible to things going wrong, why would they do anything about it? So as health professionals, I think it's so important we give strong messages of risk. We also say to the patient, you know, how do you think and feel about this? But strong messages of risk. If the patient perceives no risk, why would they change anything? But I think it's incredibly important if we're giving messages of risk that we're immediately following up with messages of benefit. We've got good study evidence. Come on board with us. Good evidence that actually we can help prevent things go wrong. And I think those messages do need repeating as well, repeating at different clinic appointments and reinforcing, and of course, reinforcing by other members of the team as well. An explanation doesn't necessarily change a perception. So, for example, you could look at diabetes as mild diabetes or a touch of sugar, or you can look at it again as a risky disease in terms of complications. Many of our patients will look at more medication means worse diabetes. We will tend to look at the patient's medication screen and think you're on some good medications for your condition. Many patients will look at injections as being the end of the line. We look at injections as, well, a different way of giving a drug. So this perceptual thing is really important. So just moving on a little bit around SMART goals and supporting patient motivation, I'm sure we're all very familiar with the kind of SMART model, specific, measurable, assignable, realistic and time related. But I think it's so important that whereas we might have longer term goals, or the patient might, that they have shorter term and achievable steps. So we could look at this in terms of patient activity or weight loss or HbA1c or blood pressure levels. Yes, longer term goal, but let's really be looking at these shorter term achievable steps. And personally, I believe it's not particularly for us to come up with the plan. I think we prompt patients to come up with their own plan, but again, really with an emphasis on being realistic. So I'm going to give an example of this around weight loss. So I think often we kind of look at weight loss or look at achieving a normal weight, a BMI perhaps under 25 for most, but actually is that entirely achievable? Well, there's a different way of looking at this, I think. If we can estimate the patient's excess weight, then actually what do they want to lose? They don't want to lose all their body weight, they want to lose the excess bit. And there's many software packages, and I believe some of our System 1, EMIS, etc., allow an estimate of the patient's excess. Now, I'll give an example of this. For a patient, someone weighs, for example, 95 kgs, they've got a BMI, in my example, of 31. So if we look at the software package, it might suggest that they're carrying an excess 22 kgs of weight. Now, they look at weight loss, they manage to achieve some weight loss. An example I'm giving, they've lost, in fact, over time, 5.5 kgs. So what is that as a percentage, not of their total body weight, but the excess weight? So I've already said that we estimate 22 kgs excess weight. They've lost 5.5 kgs. In other words, they've lost a quarter or 25% of their excess weight. And I think this can be incredibly motivating for patients to feel they can actually get there. If we look at HbA1c, yeah, we were personalising, and again, Sarah's talked through this, you know, the desperately important need to personalise in all our care, of course. But we could look at an HbA1c target longer term. But what about shorter steps? Now, I'm not necessarily advocating this for everyone, but if you've got people with a very high HbA1c who perhaps don't feel they can get there, could we repeat the HbA1c more frequently than 3 or 4 monthly? So I'll give an example of that, and that's based on Professor Kilpatrick, Eric Kilpatrick, who describes the glucose binding to hemoglobin, glycation, glycosylation, however you want to say it, as looking back over 4 months. Of course, that's right, 120 days, the lifespan of an erythrocyte. But actually, the HbA1c is very front-loaded as a test. So 50% of that glucose binding will come from the most recent month, 25% in the preceding month. So it's front-loaded as a test. So again, not advocating this necessarily for everyone, but if you've got people that you really want to encourage and get feedback in terms of HbA1c lowering, repeating that more frequently, maybe monthly or 2 monthly, can absolutely give the patient a sense that they're getting somewhere. And I do this a lot, especially with people that are really quite disengaged, again, giving them the sense that actually the HbA1c is slowly, bit by bit, heading towards target. Very motivating. The ADA-EASD consensus statement really helps us as clinicians work out where to go next. So incredibly important. And I think one of the drivers for clinical inertia, therapeutic inertia, same thing, is a lack of understanding or lack of confidence with the next step. And the ADA-EASD also emphasise the importance of trying not to do harm, and they perceive that particularly around hypoglycemia and weight gain. And I think that's absolutely right. And I think patients get very treatment averse, you know, if they perceive there's more harm from the medication than there is benefits. Okay, so what I want to do is to look at a case scenario. I've entitled this fictitiously Sandra. She's a 70-year-old lady with a 6-year history of type 2 diabetes. Her initial control, her glycemic control, was good on diet and metformin, but that's gradually deteriorated and she's asymptomatic. She's on just metformin 1 gram twice daily. Her BMI is 26, her blood pressure is 142/82, her HbA1c is 69 millimoles per mole, or 8.5% in the old money. Her eGFR, renal function, is 55 mils per minute. And she's also got retinopathy in both eyes. So do you think we need to do anything differently? And I'm sure all of you will say, well yes, you know, with the HbA1c being 69 and her having bilateral background retinopathy, we clearly should be doing something else in terms of glucose management. So where do we go from here? I would again refer you back to the ADA-EASD consensus statement, and they would emphasise let's do no harm. And I think particularly in this 70-year-old lady, that's around a hypoglycemia. Let's avoid hypoglycemia at all costs. So what might be appropriate for this lady? Well, you know, the eGFR is 55, so I think this far more favours a DPP-4 inhibitor, a gliptin perhaps like linagliptin. And just bear in mind, of course, that if eGFR declines, for most gliptins, we need to be reducing dosage. With linagliptin, of course, we don't need to do that, even with declining EGFR, and I think that can be really helpful. So just briefly and in summary, I think we do need to be stepping up Sandra's glucose-lowering therapy, avoiding harm. I personally think a DPP-4 inhibitor like linagliptin, absolutely a good call. But also let's bear in mind that EGFR, if it declines further with other gliptins, we may well need to reduce dosage down. So I just want to go on to a summary. Type 2 diabetes is often nowadays diagnosed asymptomatically. Psychologists suggest that a lack of symptoms can make acceptance, or if you like, internalization of the diagnosis difficult for patients. The belief that mild diabetes exists is widespread, not among all of our patients, perhaps, but among many of them, as we've seen by the No Worries, No Impact study. Attendance of early structured group education is incredibly important. Referral for structured education is high, attendance is very low. And I really think we should be encouraging patients to attend for structured educational programs around diagnosis. And you could very much argue that these should be repeated periodically. So early intervention, education, lifestyle strategies, pharmacological approaches are vital to reduce future risk and may well confer this legacy effect or metabolic memory. But for all of this, we really need our patients on board. We need them with us. So repeated messages, longer term goals, but shorter term next realistic steps are crucial.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. For further details of resources available as part of the T2 Discussions Trending Topics series, please do explore the other pages on this website.